It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Over the weekend, the Pennsylvania House of Representatives voted along party lines to pass a new budget. GOP leaders unveiled the budget and used little input from Democrats in the House. The governor has indicated that he will veto a budget as it begins to pass through the Senate. On the line with us now is Pittsburgh area Senator Jay Costa, joining us from Harrisburg. Senator Costa, welcome.
Good morning, Paul.
Tell us about what happened over the weekend and your view of how everything went down as this budget makes its way to the governor's desk.
Well, essentially, as you described, Republicans in the House and the Senate have come together, totally disregarded and ignored the governor's input and ignored input from Democrats, and have passed a budget out of the House. And just last night, about 11 o'clock or so, passed a budget, the same budget, out of the Senate Appropriations Committee, where it now makes its way to the Senate floor, which will be voted probably tomorrow, and then make its way to the governor's desk, where, I think, as you indicated, there's a strong possibility and strong likelihood that the governor will veto it. The measure does not include many of the things the governor wants to talk about. The increase in public education, K-12, is only $8 million, which we think, and when the governor's proposed $400 million, there's no property tax relief as part of this particular budget. There's draconian changes to the public pension systems that provide zero help this year in our budget, and questionable long-term and questionable legal aspects to the pension reform measures that are being advanced as well. So certainly it's disappointing that the Republicans are ramming through a budget that they know at this point that the governor's not likely to support.
Let's talk about the pension situation. The budget, the way it is structured in the House version, would send future state and public school hires, though not police or corrections officers, into defined contribution retirement plans, such as a 401k style retirement plan, rather than the current defined benefit pension systems that Pennsylvania and a lot of other states have. So let's start with that. What is your view of how this proposal is structured? Is it something that Democrats can get on board with?
Well, I think that's only one small part of what the pension proposal has been. There are a significant number of other types of benefit changes that both go forward with new hires, but also go retroactive and apply to all current workers. There are major constitutional issues with respect to that issue. What Republicans are trying to do in Pennsylvania, for example, has been vetted in Illinois and was stricken in Illinois. That's being unconstitutional, and that's a concern that we have as well. But there's also issues with respect to some of the benefit changes that we've talked about. There's a question as to whether or not we are able to do some borrowing, which I think most folks agree, at least this, I think there's a majority in the Senate who believe that we should consider doing some borrowing, similar to what we did when we had an unemployment compensation crisis when we owed the federal government $4 billion. At the end of the day, what we have is the pension plan is coming forward. It has no immediate impact to our school districts, no immediate impact to our state, and there's no revenue saving this year, as I mentioned. But beyond that, it exacerbates our unfunded liability, and that's a major issue. And I think that's what we've talked about. A purely DC plan for new employees would result in a doubling of the unfunded liability from $45 billion to over $90 billion. Again, those aren't my numbers. Those are actuarial numbers. Those are IFO's numbers. So at the end of the day, you've got something where it's being done for political reasons as opposed to strong fiscal reasons as we go forward. And it doesn't address the issue with respect to our funding crisis that we have to deal with respect to our pension, in our view.
And the Republicans have acknowledged that the governor's push to fund education is something that they feel is important. They have emphasized, the Republicans have, the increases in their budget, which would provide $100 million in the main K-12 budget line, $25 million for pre-K, $20 million for special education. So is it a matter of the amount of money that is being provided for education funding, or how that money is being put together?
Well, with respect to the allegation or the contention that they put $100 million in basic education, it is really, it's a shame that they're standing there saying that, because that's not accurate. Yes, they're putting $100 million into the basic education line, but they're removing more than about $92 million from two other lines in the education department that are dollars that make their way to school districts. So while school districts may believe they're going to be getting collectively across the Commonwealth $100 million, the fact of the matter is the net amount of money in the budget for school districts is $8 million. They cut $92 million from other funds. That's what's disingenuous about their statements along those lines, and that's what's frustrating. But even if it was $100 million, and the governor's put forth a plan that's reasonable, responsible, that does two things. One, it provides $400 million into the K-12 area, but also provides for funding relief and support for our families in higher education. And this budget is going to result in tuition increases across the Commonwealth with respect to our higher education institutions. But the fact of the matter is there's no property tax relief here, and that's what's important. And there's no more seller's shell tax here. The governor was looking, and I think the people of Pennsylvania wanted the governor to look and the General Assembly to look to the Marcellus community to be part of the solution with their reasonable and responsible extraction tax. This Senate Republican Senate House plan does not provide for the Marcellus industry to be part of the solution with respect to education. That's what's disappointing to us, and that's why we're not able to fund it more than $8 million in new net dollars with respect to education.
So is there a middle ground when it comes to a Marcellus shale tax? If the Republicans are willing to meet Democrats, say, halfway on this, would that be a reasonable compromise in your view?
Oh, there's no question that a reasonable compromise is available for all these areas. Senate Democrats and House Democrats have been working with Governor Wolf. We made significant concessions, particularly in the area of pensions and I think in the area of wanted spirit privatization. We've made significant concessions. Unfortunately, the other side of the aisle does not want to move off of their position of complete privatization for wine and spirits with respect to the Marcellus industry. Both Speaker Terzai and my friend and colleague, Senator Scarnati, had said that the amount that they would provide into Marcellus was zero. So you got to move off of zero, and the governor and us have moved off of where we thought we would be. For example, part of the Marcellus conversation, there was what's called a floor. The amount by which that would be, whatever the tax might be, would be applied to that floor price. Well, unfortunately, the floor price is much higher than the current price of gas. So the governor said, fine, I agree that there's some concern about that. We'll take that off the table. So the governor and we have moved forward and tried to reach common ground and find common ground. But unfortunately, we have folks on the other side who insist on either zero or their way or the highway. And that's not the way we're supposed to do things here in Harrisburg. And I think we're all working. We're trying to work towards a common ground. I expect that after June 30th, when we come back July 1st, my guess is that the governor would have likely vetoed a number of measures and that we'll begin to have those conversations again as we go forward, which I think going down a separate path, you know, privately and behind the scenes, I think we'll find common ground soon after July 1st is my hope.
So what you're saying is, Senator Costa, that you're anticipating a late budget.
I'm anticipating a late budget, and it's largely because of the party on the other side has refused to allow the governor to participate and to respect and honor the concessions that he's made in this process. They've been significant, and they've moved the ball forward, but unfortunately, you've got some leaders who are simply hell-bent on trying to force the governor to veto a budget. They want a spirit privatization bill, a pension bill, and whatever else needs to be done for whatever reason. But at the end of the day, we're not going to have a budget done by June 30th, and that's disappointing.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our guest is State Senator Jay Costa, a Democrat. And Senator Costa, we've been talking, or you've mentioned the liquor privatization plan. This has been, in recent years, something that Democrats and Republicans have argued about. Republicans want to have the state divest itself of liquor sales, and Democrats are saying they want to keep the, from what I understand, the state store system in place, maybe with some modifications. The question that comes to mind is one of revenue. What happens if there is liquor privatization? Is there as much or more revenue based on the taxing of the industry, or how exactly would that work?
Well, the proposal that passed the Senate out of the Law and Justice Committee last evening and will likely be voted on tomorrow is a measure that doesn't change the tax structure at all. The revenue that comes in from the tax side of the equation does not change. The side that does change, however, I think will be the value assigned to the net profits that the LCB provides to the Commonwealth. It's in excess of anywhere from $80 to $100 million, sometimes even higher, that makes its way to the Commonwealth. The Republicans say that they'll be able to generate $220 million in total, which is really going to be a new net of about $140 million. But as you mentioned, that would be the divestiture of the wholesale side in particular, and it would not expand the number of locations that we have across Pennsylvania. It'll allow for wine and spirits to be purchased in beer distributors, wine and spirits to be purchased in only in those supermarkets that have our licenses, and allow wine and spirits to be purchased in restaurants. While we think that there's a lot, Senate Democrats and House Democrats believe, and I believe the governor believes as well, there's no question that we have a good asset in the LCB system. Is it underperforming? Yes. Do we have plans and recommendations that we would modernize the system to a great extent? The answer is yes, without privatizing the system. We believe that there are a number of things that we prefer that would provide for about $180 million in additional revenue on top of the $80 million that we currently get. Another $180 million could be added if we employ some of the modernization techniques that we've talked about. They go to things like direct shipment. They go to things like stores within the store, expanding the number of licenses in terms of the hours that folks are allowed to operate, and more Sunday sales, things of that nature. Those are the type of things that we think that we need to do that this version that the House plans put forth doesn't do.
The system of liquor sales in Pennsylvania has been in place for a long, long time. Would Republicans, when you float these modernization proposals that you just mentioned, do you get the feeling that Republicans would meet you halfway on this at least?
Oh, absolutely. Again, as I mentioned earlier, Paul, we have conversations that are taking place where a number of items have been put on the table that are more along the lines of a modernization proposal, more so than a privatization model. For example, in our meetings with the governor and with Republicans, that we've put on the table things like wine in the grocery stores. We put things on the table with respect to direct shipment. We put things on the table that would allow restaurants to sell wine, some things of that nature. So there are a series of things that we've put on the table for a conversation that have been rejected by our friends on the other side of the aisle. And that's the frustrating part. As I mentioned to you earlier, it's either one, either our way or no way, whether it's wine and spirit privatization or whether it's Marcellus Shale Tax, where they said the amount that they're going to raise from revenue is zero. That's not the way you get to common ground and get to compromise. And that's what's frustrating in this process. And again, I think, now the difference between the last 4 years and now is that with the governor, it's a Democratic governor who believes that we should do things differently and stands ready to reject these proposals. And that's why I think it's important that folks realize that, while we're going to have some things passed here, the governor's likely to veto these items in the budget, and that will start a new conversation going forward on these issues, because they need to be resolved. We know we have to address pensions, and we agree with that, both state pensions and municipal pensions. We know that Representative Terzai has made wine and spirit modernization or privatization a priority item. So to satisfy him, even though only 2% of the people in Pennsylvania want us to deal with this issue, their preference always is that we deal with education investments, that we deal with property taxes, that we deal with pensions, that we deal with human service programs. Way at the bottom of the list is wine and spirit privatization. But at the end of the day, Speaker Terzai has made this his priority, so it's forced us to have a conversation about this issue before we advance any of the other measures.
So it sounds like you're saying that you can see the governor doing a line item veto, but not a complete veto of the entire budget.
Well, I can't speak to what he's going to veto, because the general appropriation bill is the budget bill. That's one bill. That's one piece of legislation. Wine and spirits is a totally separate and distinct piece of legislation, as is, for example, a tax code that would be for the Marcellus and pensions. They're all different pieces of legislation. I believe that I can't see how the governor could support a spending plan that he's had no input in. Now, that, to me, is not the way we do things here. Typically, when we work here, we usually have three or four parties work together to come to a compromise. But that's not where we're at here. And at the end of the day, I believe the governor will likely veto everything. But I can't speak for that right now.
Is your sense, as far as why the Republicans are taking the stance that they have, are you sensing, Senator Costa, that this is a way for a Republican-controlled legislature to put a new Democratic governor in his place?
I think that's part of it. I think that based on conversations I've had with leaders in both chambers on that issue, I think that's certainly part of it, and that we need to get through this process in order to move to a compromise position. That there's some on the other side of the aisle who believe that it is a necessary step to convince folks that in order to ultimately get to a, to get the common ground on all these issues, that this is a necessary part of the process. I disagree with that. I think that reasonable minds should come together and we should work towards a solution to these issues centered around the larger position of the governor's budget concepts in terms of, you know, making investments in education, looking to Marcellus, looking to do pension reform, looking to do property tax relief, looking to do human service program funding, you know, looking to do jobs creation programs. To me, that seems, that should be the part of our conversation that we're looking at, not looking, for example, at wine and spirit privatization. I'm sorry, at this point, we believe modernization is the approach to wine and spirits, and hopefully we'll get to that point. But yeah, I think that that is part of the story, is that they feel that in order to get folks to where they need to get them to on the other side of the aisle, that they need to have to go through this process.
And do you see a prolonged standoff here? A lot of people are concerned that, as you've indicated, it's beginning to look as though there's no way that there will be an agreement that the governor's going to sign off on this budget in time for the July 1st deadline. So now people are wondering, how long is this going to drag out? How much will be disrupted in terms of services and the kinds of things that state government pays for? What concerns do you have?
Well, we're certainly concerned about what happens after July 1st. Our expectation is, and I know what we're going to be doing, is we're going to roll our sleeves up and we're going to want to get to work now that we've got some of the process stuff out of the way with respect to doing what they have to do and the governor vetoing it. Then we can get down to real work starting on July 1st. My hope is that we can get it done as soon as possible. It may not appear likely that that might be the case. We're not going to shut down services in Pennsylvania. We're not going to have parks closing. We're, you know, everyone's going to, state employees will be paid. We have to do that. And I think at the end of the day, I think that the level of disruption, I think, will be far less this year as it had been in previous years where we had not reached budget decisions on time. So I expect that there'll be some concern along those lines, but as the longer this process goes forward, of course, Paul, things begin to change in terms of the revenue the Commonwealth has available to continue to operate. But at the end of the day, I think that it'll be less disruptive this year than in the past years, given recent court cases and things of that nature that don't let us do some of those things.
One of the things that people wanted to see get passed this year, certainly some folks, was medical marijuana. You are one of the proponents of that. A medical marijuana bill was once again passed out of the Senate this year. Is that dead in the water as we speak?
I don't think so. I know that the version that came out of the Senate over into the House was assigned to a particular committee where the chairman of that committee has decided unilaterally that he does not want to run the bill, so therefore the bill will not come out of committee or to the House floor. Other Republicans are challenging his intentions by doing what's called a discharge petition, which means that after so many days, after 10 days from the date of filing, that it forces it for a vote. So my hope is that Republicans, the bottom line is, well, there's overwhelming support in the House for the passage of this legislation, Democrat and Republicans. But as I said, you got one Republican who's holding it up at this point in time. Other Republicans are trying to force the issue with him with respect to the discharge petition. So I'm hoping that it makes its way to the House floor before we leave here for summer recess, whenever that might be. So we're keeping our fingers crossed, and we're going to continue to push for that vote over in the House, because we know that once it gets to the floor, it will pass.
So there's still a chance we could see medical marijuana in Pennsylvania this year?
Oh, this year? I would say definitely this year. But I also think that maybe before we even have our summer recess, I think there's a chance you could see it. But I think we'll definitely see it this year, yes.
And one last question for you, Senator Costa, regarding the Supreme Court once again upholding a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Your thoughts about how this ultimately impacts people in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think the way it impacts people in Pennsylvania is that we don't no longer have to worry about an alternative plan with respect to our exchange. We have been working with the governor and with CMS to prepare to deal with a different outcome in the event that that was going to be the case. So for the people of Pennsylvania, the subsidies continue through the exchange, and we think that's a good thing because it allows folks to have a level of comfort with respect to modest level of health care coverage that I think is essential. So at the end of the day, I think it was a wonderful decision for this country, but also as it relates to Pennsylvania, it was the right decision for our folks in Pennsylvania who accessed the exchange through the federal government and received those subsidies. So that's a positive thing.
Pennsylvania Senator Jay Costa joining us on the phone from Harrisburg. Senator Costa, as always, great thanks for your time.
Anytime, Paul. Thank you.
And coming up, we'll talk with Penn Live and Harrisburg Patriot News opinions editor John Misick about the what-ifs of the budget situation. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESN. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If the state budget doesn't pass until well after the June 30th deadline, how will state workers and residents be affected? So far, officials won't say what will happen if a budget impasse lasts weeks or months, as in previous years. With no compromise in sight, we're turning to the man we always turn to in a crisis, well, sort of, John Misick, opinions editor for the Patriot News and Penn Live, joining us by phone from Harrisburg. Hello, John, and happy budget deadline week to you.
Oh, yeah, I'm living the dream, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Was it a foregone conclusion, perhaps way back in January, when a Democratic governor with an ambitious agenda was sworn in, that a budget impasse was inevitable?
I mean, I think you're right. I mean, when you have a Democratic governor who wants $33.8 billion in spending and a sales tax increase and a personal income tax increase, and you have a Republican-controlled General Assembly, it's not whether there will be sort of an impasse, but for how long it will last, I think.
So what do you make of all the maneuvering by the Republicans over the weekend to push the spending plan through the House and set it up for a Senate vote without Democratic support, really any Democratic support at all?
We'd anticipated that for quite a while, Paul. I mean, state Senate will come in tomorrow on Tuesday, kick out the general fund bill, send a liquor bill back to the House, and send a pension bill to the governor's desk, and then pretty much skedaddle. Everyone at this point expects a gubernatorial veto. The governor said, based on what he has seen of the plan so far, that's precisely what he's going to do. Whether it's a wholesale veto or whether he plans to exercise his line item veto power is another question entirely. And when I spoke with the administration this morning, they were still weighing their options on that front.
Would you be surprised if he just vetoed the whole thing? I mean, is that kind of where we're headed here?
I mean, that's certainly the indication. I mean, there's going to be some kind of veto. Again, whether it's a wholesale veto of the spending plan itself, whether it's a veto of the liquor bill or the pension bill or all three of them, because we know Wolf doesn't like liquor privatization, and that's the bill they're sending him. He's not a big fan of the pension proposal they're going to send him either. So, you know, it could be a threefer for all I know.
Why doesn't the governor like liquor privatization? I mean, I know that's been a traditionally a position of the Democrats in Pennsylvania. But, you know, this is a governor who, you know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there are a lot of people who are frustrated with the way liquor is sold in this state. And you know, Governor Wolf positioned himself during the campaign as a progressive. I mean, wouldn't it be the progressive thing to do to come up with some form of privatization here and do what basically every other state in the nation does?
Well, yeah, you know, you'd think so, right? But, you know, we're Pennsylvania. We fear change. Yeah, you know, the governor has made no secret of the fact that he's on board with what's been commonly referred to as modernization, and that is making the current liquor control board system more consumer-friendly, either with expanded Sunday opening hours or direct wine shipment or the allowing of sale of wine in the grocery stores. The administration views the liquor control board as a money-making asset for the state to the tune of a couple hundred million dollars a year. They argue that, you know, whatever it is, how much you get up front from the auction and then in tax revenue afterwards won't make up for the sale of that system. You know, the governor being a labor guy as well looks to the possible unemployment of 3,000 or 4,000 state workers there. And so that adds up for him to an argument against it.
Sounds like you're showing the signs, the effects of the hay fever season, John. Gesundheit.
Thank you. I'm fighting a cold here today.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay, I just wanted to check. Yes. Concerned about your health, as always, you know, since you're the man we always
thank you. I appreciate
turn
it.
To in a crisis. We just spoke with Senate Democratic Leader Jay Costa, and I asked him if this whole budget impasse problem, which could inevitably turn into a budget crisis, you know, and how many times have you heard that phrase uttered at this time of year over the years? But he, in this whole impasse situation, I asked him if this had something to do with a GOP-controlled legislature wanting to put a first-year Democratic governor with a big agenda in his place. And Costa said that he thinks it has something to do with this whole impasse. What do you think?
I think I'll agree with the gentleman from Allegheny County. I don't think it's a matter of putting him in place. It's a matter of two sides coming to it with dramatically different political philosophies. You know, keep in mind you have a first-year governor proposing a hugely ambitious budget who is still learning the ins and outs of Harrisburg's rather Byzantine political culture. That makes it difficult from the outset, him just being a freshman. It is further compounded, again, by the size of the spending proposal and the vast ideological gulf between the two sides. I don't think it's a matter of wanting to put the governor in his place so much as it is a matter of just mechanics.
Well, I guess maybe a better word, a better phrase might be tone setting. That, in other words, if you give, I'm sure that there's been a discussion at some point among the GOP that if they give in or give the governor too much of what he's asking for, that that's going to send the wrong message or set a bad tone for the anti-taxing and in many cases anti-spending Republicans going forward.
Let's not kid ourselves. All budgets are inherently political. In as much as they are policy statements, they are also statements of priorities. This is a governor of mine who won by 10 or 12 points last November, putting down his marker and saying, this is everything that's important to me. When you get a statement like this, you don't win by going small. It's go big or go home, so to speak. The Republicans, by the same token, are looking to build on their majorities in the House and the Senate. And, if they appear to be shrinking violets to their constituencies, that's not going to do them any favors either. I mean, the whole process is inherently, as much as it's driven by policy and what's good for the body politic, the whole process is inherently political as well.
We're talking with John Micek here on Essential Pittsburgh. He's opinions editor for the Patriot News and Penn Live, joining us by phone from Harrisburg. And we have a few minutes left with him. If you have a comment or question, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter, @ESSPGH. John, the sticking points here for the governor, we talked about the liquor privatization situation. There's also the pension situation and the biggie, a severance tax on drillers to fund education. And Governor Wolf has said that he will not accept a budget that does not include that. So where is the room for compromise here? And how do you see the governor and the legislature coming together on these issues? And if it's about politics, then it's also about saving face, I would imagine. So how do they do all that?
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to somebody about this afternoon, as a matter of fact, and I mean, what they're saying is that for things to get good, they're going to have to get awful first. So we're going to have to be sitting here in the heat of July when state agencies start running out of money and state employees start worrying about their paychecks to foment some kind of movement, and that's when the serious compromising is going to take place. I mean, there's a state senator from Blair County, John Eichelberger, who said today that they're fully expecting the governor to veto this. And then once he does the veto, and then they can get down to the serious brass tacks of negotiations. I mean, invariably, what we'll end up probably having is pensions light, liquor light, some kind of school funding plan, and perhaps some kind of severance tax. But, both sides at this juncture, with expecting a gubernatorial veto, are throwing down their markers. And then when we get on the other side of that and tempers are hot and so are the temperatures, that's when you start seeing the movements.
And when that scenario begins to play out and tempers and people start to get frustrated, including the good citizens of the Commonwealth, they're going to wonder who is at fault here. And you know, as you look at the positions being staked out, who is ultimately going to be held responsible if there is a delay, which it looks like there will be?
I am sure each side will work to the best of their ability to hold each other responsible for that. You know, it's kind of early to say who's to blame here. The Republicans claim that they're negotiating. The Wolf people claim that they're making concessions. You know, the truth is probably someplace in the middle. And then once all of this happens, you know, the governor will take to his bully pulpit and try to make the Republicans own this budget. They've already said they're going to do that. And the Republicans, to the extent they can, will say, well, the governor refused to negotiate with us, and here we are.
I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball and ask, how long will it take? Is the budget going to be late? And if so, for how long?
Oh, tomorrow at midnight is the budget deadline. So, yeah, the budget is going to be late. I've been mulling that whole how long is it going to last thing. The optimist in me wants to say sometime in the middle of July, maybe the third week of July. But more realistically, I think we're looking at sometime into August here. It's going to be kind of a repeat of 2009. Not quite 2009 when the budget still only dragged on for 101 days. They passed a stopgap plan in August of that year and had a final spending plan in place by October. I don't think it's going to go that long, but I think we'll be into August before this thing finally is settled.
When that happened in 2009, how bad did it get?
Oh, it was a car crash. I mean, make no mistake. You know, I remember that scenario very well, sitting in a very stuffy, hot caucus room on the first floor of the Capitol as they were trying to reach agreement, and tempers blowing up and people storming out and toys being thrown out of the pram. It's not fun to watch, and it does, you know, dent your face in the process somewhat. But on the other hand, you know, you have people coming to the table with very deeply held beliefs, and they're trying to score as much for their side as they possibly can. So when you view within that context, it's sort of an inevitable byproduct, I guess.
And so in the immediate future, what does this mean for the citizens of Pennsylvania, for the people listening to this saying, you know, I'm going on vacation later this week. You know, I want to know what state parks I can go to, what state services are still going to be available. And if you're in a state employee, will I, you know, have my paycheck on time? So for those
state employees, by virtue of a 2008 court decision, Paul, have to be paid even retroactively. So they're going to be okay for a while. The governor is saying that his agencies have enough money to operate, the executive branch agencies have enough money to operate through a stalemate. They're not saying for how long or for how much money they have. The legislative caucuses are saying, you know, they have some reserves, and I'm still trying to get an exact handle on how much. So it's going to be a little, it'll probably be a little touch and go, but I mean, we'll be into July, I think, probably before we start seeing any serious impact to actual taxpayers.
And what are the serious impacts that you know, if it goes that long, then what are we looking at?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to, say, 09 or 07, you start seeing DEP, DEP inspectors not being able to get out to sites. You know, unemployment, I don't think unemployment checks ever stopped flowing. That's not an issue. You know, again, the one thing that everyone seems to care about is how long are the state parks going to be open, because everyone needs someplace to go in the hot, hot weather. And that always seems to be sort of the lever upon which these negotiations turn. Like, we'll start showing up at Gifford Pin Show out here, or a Falling Water that you guys have out there, and there's a bar across the gate, and they can't get in, and they start screaming at their local lawmakers. That always seems to be what sort of moves the needle on negotiations.
And this is sort of like, I don't know, I can remember when I was a kid, these long, drawn-out, dragged-out, budget impasses, delays, and subsequent problems that would occur. It almost seems to be an annual event. At what point does somebody look at this situation and say there has got to be a better way?
We started seeing this sort of modern age of budget deadlocks with the beginning of the Rendell administration in 2003 with divided government. You know, they had a slightly easier time of it during the Corbett years, and now we're back to divided government. you know, and everyone says, well, they should start working on this earlier. And I guess you could make a credible argument to that effect because, you know, they have the budget debate, the budget hearings, rather, the week after the governor delivers the spending plan. And then everything kind of stops and everyone sort of goes away. And then they come back in May and they kind of sort of start talking about it. And then we're into June when they really start talking about it. So I guess you could make a credible argument that the process should start, you know, as budget hearings are going on, that they should start moving bills and that kind of stuff. But, you know, everyone knows, and we're all guilty of this, that you never really start doing your homework until the night before it's due. It's the pressure of the deadline, it seems like, that really moves the meter.
And now it sounds like somebody's going to have a fever and not have to go to school on the day that the homework is due.
I'm sorry, Paul, I missed that one.
Oh, and it was such a great line, too. I was saying, John, that, that you know, going along with your turning in your homework late analogy, that now we're looking at a scenario where somebody's going to have a fever and be sick and get an excuse from mom on the day that the homework is due.
Oh, exactly. And it'll be up to voters to decide how to grade them, to further hyperextend the metaphor.
There you go. There you go. John Micek, opinions editor for the Patriot News and Penn Live, joining us by phone from Harrisburg. John, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Paul, anytime.
Coming up, we'll hear about a program designed to mentor parents of young children. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Pittsburgh City Council approved an agreement with the city and Department of Public Safety aimed at mentoring parents of young children. Promised Beginnings is part of the larger Safer Together Pittsburgh initiative to improve public safety. Joining us now to tell us more about the program is its creator, Maria Bethel. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. We were talking about the Pittsburgh City Council approving an agreement with the city and the Department of Public Safety aimed at mentoring parents of young children, Promise Beginnings, part of the larger Safer Together Pittsburgh initiative to improve public safety. Explain the goal, if you would, Maria Bethel, of the Promise Beginnings program.
You know, what we thought about is, as the director, Stephen Bukar, Public Safety, we, as a public safety department, have to have a multifaceted approach to our community safety. So that requires us to have a collaborative effort with organizations within our community as well as our public safety department. And with Promise Beginnings, we want to provide workshops and mentoring sessions which promote kindergarten readiness for parents with children ages 0 to 5. You know, in that way, our goal was to create safer and healthy living and learning environments in our home and, you know, help parents become more knowledgeable about the understanding of the stages of child development, you know, getting them familiar with the Pittsburgh Promise and also promoting our public safety careers and fostering a more positive relationship with our public safety and law enforcement officers here in the city of Pittsburgh.
So when was the need for a program like this first realized, Maria?
Well, to be honest with you, prior to coming to the work for the city of Pittsburgh, I was a child advocate for CASA of Allegheny County. And I saw a need working with parents when parents were explaining to me that they felt if they had resources prior to certain crisis intervention or public safety issues or child violence or domestic violence or abuse cases, that they would have been better off. And that combined with the work that I do also with disruptive properties, I also handle that ordinance for the city of Pittsburgh. And I saw that there were constant drug charges as well as child endangerment charges occurring within the city of Pittsburgh. So those two things together kind of made me realize that we have to become more proactive in getting parents the resources they need at an earlier age for their children.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we're talking with Maria Bethel, who is the creator of the Promised Beginnings program, part of the larger Safer Together Pittsburgh initiative to improve public safety. You can join the conversation with a question or a comment at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. email ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number, if you're a parent, if you're someone who has a question about this program, you can call 412-246-2002 to join the conversation or to put a question to our guest, Maria Bethel. And someone might ask here, Maria, why target parents of preschool students?
Well, I think one of the reasons why I said it was important to target the parents is because we were developing programs, you know, in the school district. We were developing program with organizations outside, you know, which targeted community leaders and teachers. But I think one of the most important pieces is the child's first teachers. You know, our slogan is every child deserves a great beginning. So who's the first teacher of any child? It's the parents. They're going to be the first one, especially from 0 to 5, because that parent or child care or that whoever that main child care provider is going to be choosing child care, developing a relationship, developing their social skills, developing their communication skills. So the earlier that we get them the information and resources they need, we can prevent those things, crises that come in the juvenile age when they get to school. So the parent becomes, I always believe, constant parent engagement is the key. You know, I have 3 children myself who are now teenagers, 19, 16, and 13.
Wow.
Yes, on top of working full-time. And I actually myself, you know, went through a divorce. I had 3 small children under the age of 6. They were 9 months, 3 and 6 years of age, and I decided to go back to the University of Pittsburgh. When I went back to the University of Pittsburgh, I realized I had a support network. I realized my family had been working in academia, so I was familiar with the, you know, academic, you know, lifestyle, what choices I had to make, choosing appropriate child care, you know, getting advice from parents and aunts and, you know, grandparents. But a lot of our parents don't have that basis. So it becomes important that even though we're community members or we're teachers or we're parents or community leaders or law enforcement, we have to create the arena for people to get the resources they need. Because sometimes it's just people don't know where to go to get information they need. Or, you know, maybe it's not in a setting that they're comfortable with. So in developing this workshop in more of a coaching environment, you know, and partnering with organizations like the University of Pittsburgh Ready Freddy program, the Pennsylvania Western Region Office of Child Development, Keystone STARS, those organizations, PA Women's Work, you know, trying to partner with them will allow parents to get that information resources they need.
And what resources will the program link parents to?
Well, besides the ones that I just mentioned, we also have 2 different workshops that we kind of promote. One is what we call how to say what I mean and mean what I say. So Dr. Rochelle Prelo, who's at Clarion University, goes through different communication styles and techniques, you know, how nonverbal communication can affect us as parents, how what we say affects our children, you know, and how children develop their self-worth through how we treat them and how we can impart stereotypes and prejudices against our children by what we say and communicate to them. That's an example. The other workshop with the University of Pittsburgh Ready Freddy program, you know, goes into the actual skills and what they need to go to kindergarten. And from one important thing from all the different partners that we do along with Pittsburgh Promise is the most important thing is the communication skills and the social skills before that child gets to school that will help them have a better learning environment when they get to school and a better transition throughout their school years so that they know how to approach problems. They know how to overcome obstacles and develop the appropriate actions when problems do arise. So it's very important that we start, you know, with those parents, with those children 0 to 5.
Has the program made a difference so far?
You know, we had a pilot program here in East Hills on April 17th. We actually, at that time, we partnered with our Zone 5 Police Department. We invited them, and they brought all their community resource department, our resource officers. Jason Landau is the commander in Zone 5. And what we started to see with the parents there. Not only were they getting the information they needed for kindergarten registration, how to make appropriate choices when choosing child care and child development, those sorts of things, but they were starting to foster a positive relationship with the law enforcement officers. You know, they were eating lunch with them. You know, some of them, that might have been the first time they even actually sat next to an officer, you know, in a positive relationship. You know, we did another event in the West End. At that event, we went up, we hosted with the Hope Community Connection Center there in Greenway Apartments on June 15th. Pittsburgh Gifted Center was kind enough to allow us to use that facility to host the event. And one thing we partnered to then with Zone 6 as well. Christopher Ragland is the police commander there, and Julie Ott, who is our community resource officer there, and also our fire bureau. When we did that event, we were able to feed them lunch and found out they didn't have, some of the kids were going hungry while we were there. So not only did we give them information on fire safety, and they were able to get smoke detectors and carbon monoxide, along with that kindergarten registration, but fortunately Keystone Stars were able to provide 50 box lunches for them so that those kids would eat, and we connected them to future departments, to other departments, so in the future that they will be able to get a lunch program that services that area.
And we're down to just about 30 seconds or so, but what would you say to parents who are unsure whether or not to join your mentoring program?
Well, this is what I would say. You know, our main goal is to create, basically connect parents to organizations that already exist. The better families we have, the better neighborhoods we'll have, and a better Pittsburgh we'll have. And that's the key. So always remember that if you're your child's first teacher, you have to be the first step in the process in making this a better city.
We have been talking about the Promised Beginnings program. It is part of the larger Safer Together Pittsburgh initiative to improve public safety, and the creator of the program, Maria Bethel, has joined us by phone. Maria Bethel, thank you so much for sharing the details on this, and we'll have a link to information about the program at our website at WESA.FM. Maria, again, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to hear past segments, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. Tomorrow, we will continue to monitor the situation as the budget deadline at the state capitol approaches. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.